With the high winds, we were grateful to be in one of the few AT shelters with four walls and a door we could close. By the end of the day, we were back in the land of little ups and downs, with sap on our hands and thick mud on our boots. "You fellows get right in," Jan said when he met us. "Don't worry about your boots. I need to wash this thing anyway." He giggled and sniffed the pine on his hands after high-fiving Ninja Mike. That night, while Ninja Mike, Tupac, and Breakfast Club ate with Aish, I sat in a bar across the street, glad to be alone for an hour. I was gnawing on a chicken wing when my phone vibrated. I licked two fingers and used them to extract my phone from my pocket and read the text. "Guess where I am, LOL." "First, tell me who you are," I typed back, then reached for another wing while I waited. A minute later, my phone vibrated again. "Oh, sorry. Katie gave me your number, LOL. That narrowed it down to someone on Earth who wasn't Katie or me. Who did I know that would be so difficult? Megan. My phone vibrated again, and this time it was a photo of someone pulling a nightcrawler out of the dirt. Or maybe it was the close-up of a frog being dissected. Then came the text. "Just pulled this out of blister on my heel. At Hudson's. Going to doctor tomorrow." I turned my phone off and tried to finish my hot wings and beer. When I climbed into my bunk, Breakfast Club was still awake in the bunk below mine. "Hey, Green Giant," he whispered. "I set my alarm a little early. We're going with full packs tomorrow." "Oh, okay. How come?" "I feel like we're getting a little spoiled, you know? Soft." He made sense. The whites had been on everyone's minds. Every southbounder praised the beauty while warning us of the difficulty, and as Vermont kept getting taller and steeper, we were starting to believe them. They had just been there, and they were calling the mountains we had dropped our packs to get over a nice, easy relief. Additionally, we all planned to pick up our cold weather gear in Hanover near the state line. That would add pounds to our packs immediately before the most challenging climbs on the entire AT. Instead of building our endurance, we had been acting like day hikers for a week. In retrospect, this was a terrible idea. "Yeah," I turned onto my side, "I do know. Terrible idea or not, it had been nice." Aish said he was sad to see us go. He had really enjoyed helping and serving us. We offered a collective donation that barely covered their expenses, and Aish accepted it gladly. The money in his palm made him giddy, almost as much as Jan, when he dropped us off for the final time. "You guys sure do have heavy packs." He swung mine by the straps as he hoisted it from the van. "Whee!" During our short trip back to the trail, Jan spoke excitedly about other yellow delis. "They were everywhere," he said. "Brazil, that's where the mate comes from. Australia, Peru, Europe, everywhere." This intrigued me. I love to travel. These guys had really treated us right, and it was a cheap place to stay, too. When Jan handed me my pack, after thanking him, I asked if he had a card or something listing all their locations. His face was pure joy. "I do! Hee-hee! It's in the van! I'll go get it!" He ran to the passenger door and returned with a pamphlet for each of us. The back cover was full of city names. We thanked him one more time and said goodbye, and Jan drove off. The others handed me their pamphlets and headed straight for the trail. "Use these for kindling, dude," Breakfast Club said. "Or toilet paper. Just don't read them." He pointed to the woods. "Get in there. Hurry." "That was some next-level shit right there, man," Tupac said. "What are you talking about?" "Dude, you just gave money to a cult and then asked them for a pamphlet." "Sweet baby Buddha, those fuckers were spooky," Ninja Mike hooted. I laughed. "You're being dramatic. They're nice people. Their religion is based on helping others, and I want to help them get to heaven, that's all. Turn that thing over." The pamphlet was titled, "Like a Beehive." Inside was a simple drawing of figures that looked more like aliens than humans. They were stacking hexagonal blocks. "Every one of us an equal," the caption read. "When someone joins," Breakfast Club explained, "they give everything they own to the community." "Aish gave us the pitch last night while you were at the bar," Tupac said. "They've had some heavy hitters join," Breakfast Club continued, "like CEOs and shit. They're building their own hydroelectric plant somewhere up north. They're not just off the grid, they're making their own grid." Tupac nodded. "Next fucking level, bro." Ninja Mike started up the trail. "Let's go, boys. God damn, it's good to be back in the woods." I folded the pamphlet and shoved it into my pocket. Breakfast Club held his arms out like Frankenstein's monster and lurched toward me. One of us. One of us. Tupac added a pretty accurate hee-hee. We chased after Ninja Mike, who was once again grateful for the day. The remaining 50 or so miles of Vermont did not go quickly, and while the climbs were small, there were many of them. The views were worth the work. These mountains felt like home with the familiar rounded edges I knew from the Smokies, but covered with pines, lichens, and moss. Squirrels chattered, hurrying to bury nuts and acorns. The green tunnel was starting to turn yellow. Our last day in Vermont was a series of small climbs, finishing with a long, steady descent into Hanover, New Hampshire. Hanover pulls double duty as a trail town and a college town. Dartmouth is there. So was our cold weather gear at the post office. For me, that meant a fleece hat and a puffy, down-filled jacket. By the time we finished at the post office and walked across town, it was dusk. Behind the school soccer field was Tent City for hikers, mostly deserted. The bubble was nowhere to be seen. Instead of a tent, Tupac strung a hammock between two trees, and Breakfast Club did the same. Ninja Mike just put a plastic tarp down, then wrapped himself in an old wool army blanket. Good night, boys. That's it? What do you do if it rains? He wraps the tarp around himself, Tupac explained from his hammock. We call that the Ninja Mike burrito. I turned back to Ninja Mike. Really? He was already asleep. He wasn't asleep for long. None of us were. The reason Tent City was abandoned was because the bars were still open. At 2 a.m., the woods behind the soccer field turned into a circus. Someone grabbed my tent and shook it. Hey, do I know you? Do you have any booze in there? Someone else was flashing a light. You don't know who that is. Leave them alone. Shut up. All these tents look the same. For the next hour, stakes were hammered, and flies were unfurled, and people laughed and tripped over each other in the dark. It was almost 3 before the chaos subsided. Because we were up all night and in the shade the next morning, no one stirred until well past second breakfast. Ninja Mike was grumpy and begrudgingly thanked the universe for another day while Breakfast Club roasted a bagel over our small fire. Tupac made coffee using his bandana as a filter. I asked him how much of his sweat was in each cup, but he swore that the cloth had no other use, and when I accepted a cup, it was delicious. The bubble emerged from their tents like a brood of cicadas. Their noise was incredible, and they left nothing behind. That's actually a compliment. They did an excellent job of cleaning up, especially considering their number. There must have been 50 tents around us when the ruckus began. Within an hour, Tent City was ours, and ours alone. The soccer field, however, was overrun. There were girls with hula hoops and men flying kites. Someone was playing fetch with a small dog that kept getting confused by the nearby game of frisbee. Someone yelled, "Miss Janet is here!" and the herd migrated toward the white van parked at the other end of the field. We crammed the last of our things into our packs and bolted across the field. Surrounded by hikers, Miss Janet exuded an air of motherly love and hard authority. Her face shone like the sun, and her voice rang with deep southern charm. Her hands fluttered as she greeted and hugged adoring hikers from the mob surrounding her. "Now, y'all, I have one more run to make before I take y'all's things to Mr. Ackerley's. If 2 or 3 y'all want to sit with the gear till I get back, the rest of y'all can start hiking." I wiggled my way through the crowd. "Miss Janet, so nice to finally meet you. I'm Green Giant." She looked me up and down. "Yes, you are." I blushed, feeling like the new kid at school. She gave us permission to add our gear to the growing pile, and just like that, we were slack-packing to Mr. Ackerley's with the bubble. Bill Ackerley was known as the Ice Cream Man. His house was less than 100 yards from the trail and was a famous respite for hikers because of his hospitality. He didn't run a hostel. Much like our friend Tom in Dalton, Bill Ackerley is retired and offers the use of his yard as a courtesy to thru-hikers. He holds croquet matches for them and keeps a stocked freezer on his back porch filled with ice cream. Before I knew it, the 4 of us had been swept away along with the herd. The biggest group I had hiked with had been 5, with maybe the occasional 6th for an hour or so. Counting this group was futile. I thought there were 15 of us, but 8 or 9 more greeted us at the first water stop. They made reference to the other 6 up ahead, and that's when I stopped trying. Over the course of the next 17 beautiful miles, I introduced myself to as many of them as possible. These were the same people that Mark and I had read about in the logbook on our first day back at Springer Mountain. First was Color Bandit, the guy who had been filling in all the monochrome sketches others had drawn. A huge, muscular dude who wore a championship wrestling belt was Chosen, part of the Shrimp Gang, along with Papa Shrimp and Shrimpette. There was Hufflepuff, Barticus, Grandpa Walker, who couldn't have been a day over 25, Yukon, Man-Bear, K-Bar, and Smooth D. There was even a guy named Gurp. He wore a hunter's cap and kept a cat named Henry, who would come when he whistled and sometimes hid in his pack. Working my way through the bubble as we marched at full speed toward ice cream, I passed a surprising number of strangely outfitted and bizarre characters. Yogi looked like a Spartan king and hiked barefoot. His pal, Gadget, was a rail-thin goofball who hiked in a bathrobe and carried a purple ukulele. He told me he had met up with Fiddle and Jim, and their jam session that night was allegedly epic. As I maneuvered to what I thought was the front of the parade, I kept my eyes open for anyone wearing a koala hat. Rumor was that Lemmy was a day or two ahead of us now. He had passed us while we were at the Yellow Deli, but hadn't signed the logbooks like we agreed. It was dark long before we arrived. At a high cliff named Holt's Ledge, which the guidebook described as precipitous drop-off with views, we gazed at the full moon rising above the ridge across the valley, illuminating the rocks where we stood. The tiny lights below were our goal. After an hour of fumbling over rocks by headlamp, we found Mr. Ackerley's house. Unlike Tom's place in Dalton, Bill has no neighbors for miles. At least 20 more bubble people were on Bill's long-covered porch, drinking, smoking, and listening to music. When they saw our headlamps, they cheered. Breakfast Club found the freezer and returned with 4 fudgesicles. He passed them out, and that was our dinner. The party on the porch sounded like it was just getting started. Knowing how many people were still behind us, I made no attempt to sleep. As the other hikers arrived, the party became an uproar. Jokes were met with unnecessarily riotous laughter. People were falling over. 4 different songs were playing simultaneously. I leaned close to the young lady sitting beside me. "I don't want to be that guy, but isn't Mr. Ackerley trying to sleep?" She pointed her thumb toward the house. "He told us he takes out his hearing aids before bed. We could set off fireworks right now and he'd never know." "Then I guess I'll let my hair down and get a little crazy tonight, too," I said. "Breakfast Club, another round of fudgesicles, my good man." For the second consecutive night, we stayed up late and slept past sunrise. Somehow, the majority of the porch crew was already packed and gone by the time the 4 of us stumbled onto the back deck, squinting and rubbing our heads. Ninja Mike was still wrapped in his wool blanket, and he wore a crown of wildflowers one of the girls made for him. He winked at me. "I am grateful for this day, for sure. How you doing, brother?" "I was just thinking that the only reason we didn't join a cult back there is because we might already be in one." Bill made pancakes for us, and after our late breakfast, he and I talked on the porch. I was curious about his bird feeders, which led us to a discussion of wildlife, and eventually to the 2 of us poring over an old field guide, trying to identify a small creature I'd seen days before. It was a mink. Once again, we found ourselves swept away with the herd and drawing ever closer to Mount Musalak, which marked the beginning of the whites. The whole day felt like Sunday when it's hard to enjoy the day off because you know what's coming. Plus, it rained all day. Hard. When the 4 of us arrived at Hiker's Welcome Hostel near the base of the mountain, once again, it was dark. This was our last chance for laundry for at least a week, and with a single dryer, it took hours before everyone was warm and happy again. Someone in the kitchen told me there was a 12-pack in the fridge with my name on it, left for Green Giant by someone named Joe. That was Forager's real name, but why would he use that? And Forager was more of a liquor guy. Weird. "I'll take 2, you guys split the rest." The bunkhouse was full, so the caretakers set up a large canvas tent in the yard and filled it with cots and mattresses. I collapsed onto mine and was asleep in seconds. I dreamed about Mount Musalak. It is the tallest and steepest mountain for hundreds of miles, and immediately following it is a never-ending series of mountains just as tall and just as steep. It is the beginning of the end. For the first time in days, I was awake before dawn. I hadn't slept long, but I slept hard. The bubble was preparing for the big climb, nearly 4,000 feet of continuous uphill. Some people packed, while others sat on their cots, quietly staring at their guidebooks, psyching themselves up. There was a koala hat on the cot in the corner. Lemmy was here. And he was wearing a dress. The elevation profile for Mount Musilak resembles the first drop of a big roller coaster. There is a long, steady rise that lifts you higher than you're really comfortable being, and then it throws you over a sudden decline so steep you're practically in free fall. It fills you with adrenaline, and for years, one of the way hikers have coped with that specific flavor of fear is by wearing dresses. It's something like Hike Naked Day, but regional. Depending on whom you ask, the tradition is either on its way out or enjoying a resurgence. About half the men in the room were dressed like fancy ladies and princess fairies with big feet and hairy legs. All of the women were simply dressed like hikers. Lemmy's curly hair was wild, and he wore a simple green gown with rainbow-striped socks. "Your beard really makes that outfit work," I told him. He wasn't ready to go, but with a limited number of places to stay on the other side of the mountain, I knew we'd meet again that night. I told him he looked pretty and carried my pack outside, and Tupac and I set out. Less than a mile past the hostel was a wide brook. The water was barely ankle deep, and had we been climbing any other mountain, I would have splashed through without a care. But with a 4,000-foot elevation change comes unpredictable weather. Down here, it was supposed to be sunny and in the 60s, but nearly a mile up, it might be freezing. I took off my shoes and waded across. Tupac opted to get wet and splashed through. He was at least a half a mile ahead by the time I dried my toes and put my shoes and socks back on. The first 1,000 feet of elevation came gradually, stretched out over a mile and a half, with meadows, a few narrow brooks, and even a small pond. After crossing one final paved road, the trail became steeper, but with plenty of switchbacks, so the grade was steady and predictable for a few more miles. The switchbacks carried me past smaller streams, more mossy rocks, and lichen-covered pines. The air was becoming cooler, and since this was probably the last water I would see until the other side, I filled both bottles and ate a Cliff Bar while I waited for my chemical drops to kill any microbes. The next hour of hiking was even steeper and rockier. The trail was a thin line of exposed rock, barely visible through the encroaching tuckamore, as the stunted alpine trees are called. Multiple times I needed to haul myself up by a root or branch, and then suddenly there were no more trees. The last mile to the summit was bare rock, fully exposed. The wind shoved me backward with every other step and made my ears ring and hurt, so I stopped to put on my rain jacket as a windbreaker and swapped my feathered hat for a buff. Wiping my watering eyes and squinting at the view, I saw something I hadn't seen in 1,000 miles, wave upon wave of mountains reaching to the horizon and beyond. These mountains, however, did not have the familiar rounded peaks and balds I remembered from down south. The whites were pushed up during the millions of years it took for the North American continent to drift over a volcanic hotspot after Pangaea shattered. Millions of years of erosion have softened some of the peaks, but the vast majority are sheer, spiky cliffs. And the scale? I'd come nearly 2,000 miles and felt like I was seeing real mountains for the first time. I had no idea places like this existed in the eastern United States. Shoulder-high man-made rock piles called cairns marked the way to the summit. I leaned into the wind and plodded to the top, fighting the gale as much as gravity. Every few steps, I stopped to wipe my eyes and take in the view. The top was marked by an orange square sign with simple hand-painted black letters, Mount Musilak, 4,802 feet. Standing at the sign, my view was now full 360 degrees. A few feet behind the sign was a natural rock wall that would block the brutal wind, but the panorama held me in place. Among the hikers huddled behind the rocks, one in particular stood out. He wore a red windbreaker and had a dark handlebar mustache. I was trying to enjoy the view, but the man with the mustache was staring at me. I must be going crazy, I thought. That's a fake mustache. For a second, I thought I recognized him from work, but the context made no sense and my brain rejected the idea. Then he waved, "Get down here behind these rocks." There was no mistaking the strong Boston accent. "Hia, rocks." It was Joe, my friend from work. I jumped down the few steps and crouched beside him. "Dude, what the fuck?" Katie and Joe had been conspiring for weeks to make this happen. He was one of my best friends from the software company I had worked at before my hike. For the past 5 days, Katie had been emailing and texting him in Boston, where he lived, passing along my location, which in many cases was, at best, a guess. He had the gear and skills to pull off surprises like this, which was one of the reasons we got along. The fake mustache was meant as a silly dig at my shaggy appearance. Joe fished a small sack from his pack. "I was going to hike south from that hostel and intercept you yesterday, but that rain? Forget that. Sorry for the cheap beer, too. It was all I could find." Never apologize for giving someone beer, Joe. The sack he handed me was full of gifts. Joe dried his own beef jerky, and this vacuum-sealed batch was made from brisket. There was a variety of crunchy snacks, as well as some dried fruit, chocolates, and a tiny bottle of what appeared to be very expensive gin. "This looks pricey. I mean, delicious. Thanks." "It is. Don't worry about it." Joe shielded his eyes and looked up. A military helicopter with Red Cross insignia was circling while we talked. "There's no way he's landing in this wind," I said. "I don't think he's trying to," Joe replied. "He's been circling for an hour. They're either training or looking for someone. And unless we want to ride in that thing, we should get going while there's still light. The climb down is no joke. I came up it. My truck is at the bottom." Despite the quickening wind, we enjoyed a flat half mile above the trees before the roller coaster drop-off. Joe cut straight to the interesting questions as we walked. "Have you had any brilliant revelations now that you're no longer one of the jet-setters?" "When I used to make a regular hop up to Boston, I remember looking at the map and thinking it would be 2-3 hours tops." I held my fingers an inch apart. "Nothing to it, right? Now that I've walked that distance, the world feels huge again, bigger than I can imagine." Then, Joe stopped so suddenly I almost knocked him over. Two hikers were seated on rocks near the trail. "Trail's blocked," one said, not looking up. "Hiker down." We were at a bend in the trail and couldn't see around it, but from up ahead I could hear someone making the horsey sound Colonel Butcher taught me. Perseverance. But we were about to go down, not up. "What's going on?" They continued to stare at their shoes. Another raspberry sound, then a loud voice from up the trail. "He's with us." The pair looked up and the voice called out, "Let them through. He's one of us." As Joe and I cleared the bend, I recognized the man behind the voice. His stern eyes and square jaw contrasted his kind nature. It was Yukon. We'd met at Bill Ackerley's house. "What's going on?" I could hear the horsey sound again from up ahead, a long, slow exhale with flapping lips, but still couldn't see beyond another bend in the trail. Yukon frowned. "We've got a runner collapse on the trail. He's unresponsive." Yukon and quite a few other hikers were veterans. Some were combat medics, and there were even a couple of actual EMTs in the bubble. "They've been doing chest compressions for," he looked at his watch, "for way too long now." He cupped his ear and turned toward the bend. The wind stopped. There were no more horsey sounds. A quiet voice up the trail said, "We're calling it." Yukon looked back to us and shook his head. I wobbled and put a hand on Joe's shoulder. "I need to sit down." I closed my eyes at the top of Mount Moosilauk and felt the free fall. Chapter 23. Launch. Joe looked over the edge. "I don't know how they're going to do it." The rescue operation had already been underway for an hour when Joe and I arrived. They were now referring to it as a recovery, and they were calling for volunteers to help move the body down the mountain. First responders were in contact with crews on the ground, who were still 3 hours away. We stood at the top of a narrow waterfall, the wet rock beneath our feet shiny and slick. About 20 feet below us was a white blaze. Holding on to the root of a sapling, I lowered myself over the edge and strained to reach my footing, a piece of railroad tie supported by 2 steel spikes hammered into the rock. Once I was settled on the tiny ledge, I could see to the next one. And so on. The bottom step had rotted away, and only the rebar supports remained. I looked back up to Joe. "This is where you would tie a rope and lower the stretcher, right?" The idea seemed mad, but that is exactly what the recovery crew would have to do. And it would be dark by the time they started. With 1 headlamp to share and only enough thin cord to hang a food bag, we would have been ill-equipped for such an endeavor. Are we terrible people for not staying? I asked. No, not at all, he said. It's going to be hard enough to get ourselves down. Fortunately, nearly 100 volunteers were on their way, ready to position themselves in a human chain stretching from the road at the base all the way to the summit, 3,000 feet up. The small pool at the bottom of the waterfall gave us about 10 feet of flat earth before another wet, rocky scramble. I let Joe go down first. According to the guidebook, we weren't even at the steep part yet. The day was full of obstacles, not the least of which was now half a mile behind us, the dead man we had to step over to get here. The trail had been extremely narrow, and we had no choice. The recovery crew was still hours out, and anyone not assisting was in the way. While we waited for the go-ahead to descend, we learned the identity of the fallen man. He was Chad Denning. He was 39 and in the best shape of his life. In fact, he was in better shape than most people alive today. Chad was an accomplished trail and ultramarathon runner. He didn't just win races, he organized them. He also led hiking clubs and running groups all over New England and directed national programs to promote health and outdoor education for young people. Friends and colleagues referred to him as Superman because of his incredible athletic condition. Chad and two friends had hiked up Mount Musalak that day and stopped to enjoy the view. He was smiling, about to say something. A second later, he was on the ground. The official cause of death was later found to be sarcoidosis, a rare heart condition. We were at the bottom of another difficult scramble when Joe and I encountered the first members of the recovery team, two volunteer firemen lugging heavy coils of rope. Are we close? They were already drenched in sweat and looked exhausted. It took us an hour to get down this far, so maybe? Not too long after them, we met the guys with the stretcher. Then, two more behind them carrying more rope. As Joe and I climbed down the mountain, the grim parade pulled themselves up past us to the top. Hours later, when Joe and I finally reached the bottom, the trailhead parking lot was clogged with emergency vehicles and the cars and trucks of all the local volunteers hauling rope, water, and other provisions to the top. The human chain would be there for many hours, and they needed to eat and drink too. The logistics were staggering. Before Joe surprised me, I had thought I would spend the night in the Eliza Brook shelter, 8 miles beyond the trailhead. There was no way I could make it before dark, even if we hadn't been held up at the summit. Miss Janet had already taken the bubble to the nearby town of Lincoln, where a friend of hers offered floor space for hikers. We took Joe's truck. On our way to Lincoln, he and I talked about how beautiful and treacherous the hike down had been. But what was really on our minds was Chad. I had never met him, but I felt like I had. How could I miss someone I never knew? In Lincoln, we pulled over when we spotted Ninja Mike walking beside the road without his pack. He jogged to the truck and smiled when he recognized me. He had already claimed space on the floor back at the house and was on his way to a burger joint. He was happy to ride in the back, and as we sped up, Ninja Mike closed his eyes and let his hair fly in the wind. Tupac and Breakfast Club were seated at the bar with a half-full beer and an empty shot glass each. Breakfast Club waved. Did you hear? I nodded and pointed to a table. He shook his head and pointed at the TV. I sat at the table while Joe used the men's room and Ninja Mike went to the bar to order our first round. It occurred to me that my sorrow for Chad had transformed into respect with a tiny hint of jealousy. His last conscious thought had to have been one of joy. He was smiling, about to say something. I took a breath and meditated upon the last few years of my own life, sifting through random memories. Quite a few involved mountaintops or waterfalls, but the majority took place in gray, windowless conference rooms, featuring men in neckties arguing over ones and zeros. Based on what little I knew of Chad, it seemed that if you chose a random sample from his life, there was a strong probability that he was on the trail or atop a mountain doing something that he loved, most likely with someone he loved. That was where the hint of jealousy came from. The respect came from realizing that he had increased that likelihood on purpose. Chad Denning engineered a life that kept him surrounded by everything he loved most, and in doing so, he not only followed bliss, but became a source of it. A second later, he was on the ground. When would my moment come? And where? Right here, at this table? What about a year from now, in some nice but inoffensive cubicle? If I haunted the break room, would I be a happy ghost? Probably not. The idea of haunting a mountaintop had much more appeal than the copier room on the 6th floor downtown. Hell, I'd prefer a water source, or even a privy, as the setting for my final breath. Ninja Mike came back with 3 beers. Joe was still in the bathroom. Fucking crazy day, brother. He put a beer in front of me, and I thanked him. He sat and put a beer in front of Joe's chair. Your buddy seems pretty cool. Yeah, he's one of the good ones. Ninja Mike sipped his beer and opened a menu. You guys used to work together back in the real world, right? Think you'll go back? I don't know, man. I still have some time before I need to decide, but I do know this. Joe was back. What's that? I raised my glass. I am grateful for today. Ninja Mike raised his glass. Right on, brother. The 3 of us clinked our glasses and drank to life. Ninja Mike put his phone on the ground and stepped back. From its tiny speaker came a soft flute crescendo accompanied by some discordant twanging, followed by a low, somber tone. Ninja Mike breathed deeply and assumed a battle stance, raising a trekking pole like a sword above his head. Suddenly, he leapt into the air, spun around, and slashed an invisible foe. His left foot flew into the face of another. The flute dropped an octave, and Ninja Mike performed a one-handed cartwheel, using his pole to hack at yet another foe's Achilles heel. He stuck the landing, spun again, and bowed. Miss Janet clapped and cheered. According to a long-standing rule, anyone who forgets something in her van must do a dance to get it back. During yesterday's chaos, Ninja Mike had left his poles behind. That was terrific, honey. Now get in the van, y'all. Hurry up. Everybody's waiting. She dropped us off at the trailhead to a scene much quieter than the day before. Her van and 2 other cars were the only vehicles in sight. The sun was just hitting the exposed rock cliffs on the north face of Mount Musalak, and there were neither crowds nor flashing lights. The very first thing the trail had lined up for us was a 1,000-foot climb as steep as the descent from Mount Musalak. After that, we could expect a few more little ups and downs, then one big climb, Kinsman Mountain. Breakfast Club pointed at the guidebook map to a stream on the other side of Kinsman. This looks flat. If we stealth there, it's a 15-mile day. That'll get us mostly caught back up. Tupac and Ninja Mike agreed. I told them they were crazy. Have you guys not heard a single word any of the Sobos told us? Even Miss Janet said the whites would cut our mileage to 1/3. Not by 1/3, to 1/3. Tupac presented his case. We were cranking out 20s with ease back in Vermont. Okay, sure, we were slack-packing, but it didn't make that much difference, right? Look at the map. This is only a little steeper. It's early. I'm positive we can make 15 miles. He scoffed. Those are beginner numbers. Ninja Mike was way ahead of us. He disappeared over the first rock pile, and Breakfast Club shrugged and followed. I let them go ahead. 11. That's what I predict. There's a shelter right on the other side of Kinsman that puts us at 11 miles for the day. If you guys make it past there, I'll give you $1. But you'll have to backtrack to collect, because I'm only doing 11. It took us the entire day to go 7 miles. The Eliza Brook shelter was supposed to be our lunch stop, but when I arrived, it was almost dark. Ninja Mike was already rolled up in his blanket, and Tupac and Breakfast Club were tossing sticks into a fire. "Boy, am I glad to see you guys here," I said. I was starting to think I was alone. Tupac looked up from the fire. "That was an ass-kicker. What the hell just happened?" "The whites just happened, that's what." Each of what looked like little ups and downs turned out to require as much handwork as footwork. We had to lash our trekking poles to our packs and pull ourselves up and down 50-foot rock walls all day. This shelter was the last stop before a 2,000-foot climb. 2,000 feet would have been a warm-up back in the Smokies, I thought, but right now I didn't even have the strength to brush my teeth. "Guys, we averaged 1 mile per hour today," Breakfast Club announced. Tupac shook his head. "Nope, not even that." In addition to misjudging our speed, we had also misjudged our appetites. Switching from legs only to a full-body workout required twice the calories, and we needed a resupply before tackling the rest of these mountains. If we could get to the next road crossing, which was 9 miles north, by lunchtime the following day, we could hitchhike back into Lincoln, get food, and be halfway up our next monster climb before dark. We'd still be only one day behind schedule, but at least we'd have food. It was almost dark when I got to the road. Ninja Mike was already in Miss Janet's van, and Tupac and Breakfast Club were tossing their packs into the back. Boy, am I glad to see you guys here. We found supplies and some cheap floor space back in Lincoln. It was well past hiker midnight by the time we had dinner, and I collapsed soon after. Morning came too soon, and after another hitchhike back to the trail, we found ourselves once again at the bottom of something beautiful and intimidating. Mount Lafayette is among the tallest and most iconic mountains, not just on the AT, but in the eastern United States. Its peak is well over 5,000 feet and can only be reached by traversing Franconia Ridge, a 3-mile knife edge of moss-covered rock, all above treeline, towering over steeply angled drops on both sides. On a clear day, the view can stretch for over 100 miles. At the campsite near the halfway point, Breakfast Club reminded us that we were now a day and a half behind our original schedule. Tupac suggested that we just throw out the schedule. We could hear the wind about 300 feet before we emerged from the tree line. Stepping out onto the exposed rock, we felt the strong but warm breeze. Walking along Franconia Ridge was like hiking in the sky. Craggy drops on either side of the worn rock path fell hundreds of feet into lesser waves of peaks and valleys. Haze obscured the horizon, and big clouds approached. Not far above, rays of sunlight broke through to cast spotlights on the shadowy sea of pines below. For an hour, we walked the winding granite tightrope through the clouds amid yellow beams of light. Some of the lower clouds piled up along the ridge below, building in height and mass until they rolled over us in slow-motion waves of gray, crashing on the rocks, leaving blue sky and golden streaks in their wake. Dumbstruck, we climbed higher. At the summit, the clouds were too thick to take in the view, but after 3 miles of continuous, sweeping panorama, we had no complaints. The next 4 miles were a slippery struggle in near whiteout conditions. Not only are the shelters in the whites well-maintained and beautiful, but they often have a caretaker. At Garfield Shelter, ours told us to hunker down before she retreated to her tiny shack. She had radioed the weather station at the base, and the forecast was grim. High winds and freezing rain. The good news was that our shelter was unusual in its design. It still had one open wall, but instead of the classic box, this one had an L-shaped floor plan that allowed us to sleep out of direct wind. I thought back to hail in the Smokies and climbing Roan Mountain at night. That time I slept in a shitter. These things did nothing to prepare me for the torrent that was unleashed on us that night. Garfield Shelter is almost as big as my house, and I was afraid the whole structure would blow away. Large pines bent nearly over, and 3 times something slammed against the wall in the dark outside. The L-shape did keep out the direct wind, but it also acted as a funnel, so there was a permanent cyclone of cool mist swirling in one corner. The storm only intensified at sunrise. Breakfast Club volunteered to brave the quarter-mile descent to our water source and collect for all of us. We were just beginning to worry when he finally returned. His raincoat was torn and his hair was soaked. 2 of the water bottles were missing. "Guys, we're not going anywhere today," he informed us as we helped him in. The trail was a whiteout. He'd fallen twice, and the wind had knocked him over 2 more times. On his way back to the shelter, he'd met the caretaker. News from down low was that this thing was turning into a full-blown squall. "They're saying 50 to 60 miles an hour, sustained." I started boiling water for coffee. "So what do we do? Zero here at the shelter? What else can we do?" We spent the entire day sitting in the L-shaped box, watching the trees bend over and telling stories. By lunchtime, everyone needed a nap. We were tired from not doing anything. When we woke up at 3, the weather was still treacherous. Bored, we'd eaten an entire day's rations, huddled together in a tiny rumbling box. I smiled at Breakfast Club. "What are you looking at?" "You ever see one of those old cartoons where 2 people are stranded on a desert island, and one of the guys starts to see his buddy turn into a hot dog or a steak with arms and legs?" "Yeah. I was just thinking that you look like a Snickers bar right now." Ninja Mike laughed. "You look like a joint." "Sorry, can't help you there," I said, reaching for my pack. "But I do have this gin from Joe." It wasn't much to split 4 ways, but it warmed us up and helped us sleep. Overnight, the storm broke, and the next day we finally climbed down from Mount Garfield, slipping and falling multiple times on the wet rocks. My palms were scraped and bloody from grabbing at branches to stop a long, uncontrolled skid. Ninja Mike had a large purple bruise on his right butt cheek from an earlier fall. He was proud of it and gave his daily reports on its changing size and shape. I was about to suggest second breakfast when we saw a sign for Galehead Hut. The whites are not only spectacular and challenging, they are also popular. To help ensure safety and comfort for those who visit, the Appalachian Mountain Club, the same group who provides caretakers and maintains the shelters, runs a number of lodges at some of the range's most scenic locations. These lodges, or huts as they're officially known, must be what the man with the ridiculously heavy pack back in the Smokies thought all shelters on the AT would be like. Some of the huts had room for over 100 guests or more, with stacked bunks, running water, flushing toilets, and full-sized kitchen operated by a crew who served meals to the guests in a real dining room, with dishes. The huts were big time. When we got there, they still had leftover pancakes and hot chocolate from breakfast. When Ninja Mike and the others finished eating, I stepped outside and checked my phone on a whim. One bar came and went. I took a chance and called Katie. She answered on the first ring. "Hi, Green Giant. I missed you." Every other word was a crackle. "I missed you, too. It's been a while." Crackle. "Bet you've been busy." Static. "How were the whites?" I laughed and told her I was still in them. "Oh, everything okay?" Our miles had been single digit every day, I explained, and the last 15 had taken us almost 3 days. The terrain was exactly as rugged as we'd been warned. No exaggerations. Each of us already needed to replace gear. Luckily, the hut had some things we needed for sale, such as hats and gloves. I heard her say something about Voldemort. The only words I could make out were Hudson and Hanover. "I don't know if you can hear me, but we're shooting for Mount Washington day after tomorrow. I'll call you if I can." I looked at the screen. The call had already dropped. Ninja Mike joined me outside. The sky was clear and blue again, glistening rocks, the only visible sign that the weather had not always been this idyllic. "You ready, brother?" he asked me. If things got so crazy with no warning here, what the hell was happening further north? How insane is Katahdin right now? What's it going to be like in 2 weeks when it's almost October? I put on my pack and tightened the straps. Ninja Mike was waiting for a reply, so I looked him in the eyes and told him the truth. Nope. That night, I enjoyed a rare opportunity to stealth camp in the whites. I found a little flat spot near a small waterfall and a footbridge, simply too lovely to pass up. The rest of the gang were at a shelter 2 miles ahead. Around midnight, I thought it was raining, but the sound was really just the leaves falling onto my tent. When I climbed out in the morning, the ground was bright yellow. After packing up, I kicked and rustled my way to the shelter, where Tupac and Breakfast Club were still milling about. "Hey, Green Giant, we wondered what happened to you. Did you stealth?" "Yeah, about 2 miles back. Pass me the logbook." There was no note from Lemmy. At this point, I had no idea if he was ahead or behind. Just in case he was behind, I signed my name and drew the Green Giant smiley, then passed the book back to Tupac. "Where's Ninja Mike?" "He just left." "Want to talk about Mount Washington?" I did. Mount Washington is known for regularly recording the highest wind speeds on Earth. The world record was set there in 1934, when the observatory at the summit withstood a blast of 231 miles per hour. It is the highest peak in the Northeast, and the AT goes right over the summit. We wanted to reach the top today, but the only shelter beyond the peak was 5 miles further. Having finally learned to manage our expectations, we settled for the hut right before the top, Lakes of the Clouds Hut. The name itself made me want to stay there. The huts cost money, but they also offer what's known as work for stay, which is exactly what it sounds like. A few thru-hikers get the opportunity to work in the kitchen or clean the building in exchange for a very nice place to stay for the night. They had a limited number of work-for-stay slots each day at Lakes of the Clouds, so we would have to time our arrival just right. We descended into Crawford Notch, just over 1,000 feet above sea level, enjoying jaw-dropping views the entire time. Across the notch, we could see towering rocky cliffs that we knew were the first in a series of false summits, which eventually led to Mount Washington, which was just over the horizon. At the bottom of the notch, we realized that those cliffs were the AT, Webster Cliffs, according to the guidebook, had a half-mile exposed traverse with many views. Excited, we charged toward the climb. Again, we found ourselves strapping poles to packs and hoisting ourselves up by roots and rocky handholds. The green tunnel was occasionally so tight that we practically wriggled through it, eventually bursting through the tree line and on to boulder-filled outcroppings like rock stars taking the stage. At each successive stage, we felt more like aging rock stars, and for the fourth time in as many days, we reached our planned lunch stop long after lunch. It was 3 p.m. when we entered the clearing at Mitzvah Spring Hut. The sky was silver, and the big round thermometer by the door read 58 degrees. When the wind blew, the pines sprayed us with mist. Ninja Mike waved from inside and opened the door. "Guys, you're just in time. He's taking work for stays, and we're the only ones here. Come on, I think they need four. Hurry up." We met the guy in charge, a lanky fellow in an apron with a shaved head and a neat, long beard that hung past his chest. "Sit tight, guys. I'll see what the crew needs in the kitchen to prep for dinner." The four of us put our packs and coats on hooks by the door and sat on a bench. The guy with the long beard appeared at the kitchen door a moment later and waved us over. "Fellas, I feel like a real jerk for having to do this, but I screwed up. It's only 3 o'clock. We pick work for stays at 4. I forgot what time it is. I'm sorry. My fault." "No worries, man," Ninja Mike replied. "Can we just come back in an hour?" "Sorry, you're not allowed to wait. It's a weird rule, but we're supposed to take whoever shows up at 4, not who's already here." It was a weird rule, but his confident, well-rehearsed delivery suggested that he'd also heard every rebuttal and that resistance was futile. "How much would it cost for us to stay?" Breakfast Club asked. $125. He winced. "You mean total, right?" "Nope. Each." "Ow. Never mind." We regrouped by the door and tried to come up with a plan. The mist had become drizzle. I took out my map. "Lakes of the Clouds is 6 more miles. If we leave immediately, we can get there before dark." Tupac said, "5 of those 6 miles are above treeline. Exposed." "I know. That's why we have to leave now." We'd already wasted half an hour. It was September, so the days of 14 hours of sunlight were long gone. It would be dark in a few hours, and we were standing still. Ninja Mike had another plan. "It's getting pretty sketchy out there. I'm going to stay outside till 4 and hope he forgets me and try again." "What are you going to do if he turns you away?" "What are you going to do if Lakes of the Clouds turns you away?" He had a good point. What were any of us going to do, really? There were cliffs behind us, cliffs ahead of us, and no flat spots, only huts. The drizzle was picking up. "I'm going to do what I always do," I told him. "I'm going forward. I'm tired of constantly falling short of my goal for the day, and I think if I leave now, I can get above the mist." Lakes of the Clouds hut was above 5,000 feet, where camping is forbidden, so I was banking on arriving at dusk and relying on the caretaker's mercy. It would be dark and cold, and if it came down to it, I'd throw down the credit card. I told the guys I'd see them up there for second breakfast and stepped out. While I was tightening my pack, I checked the thermometer again. 54. The temperature had dropped 4 degrees since we arrived. The trail resumed at the other side of the clearing, and I walked into the tight tunnel of thick, small pines. Rocky and too narrow for switchbacks, it went straight to the top. The rocks were mostly granite, light gray slabs that sparkled from the drizzle. Hiking through the pine boughs was like going through a car wash. My raincoat was saturated and my legs were soaked. Thanks to all the effort I was exerting, at least I was warming up from the inside. Whenever I came to a brief break in the trees, my hood would slap my face on the windward side. A few times, the white blazes were difficult to locate, often at the top of vertical scrambles. The higher I climbed, the stronger the wind. I left the tree line for good, somewhere near the peak called Mount Eisenhower. According to a sign, the actual summit was at the end of a loop trail, but I couldn't tell which way because the wind had knocked the sign free of the pile of rocks that served as its base. The wind was coming from behind, so I had to lean backward while I walked forward. My poles kept slipping on the wet rocks and were only useful when they kept me from falling. I leaned back more and held them in front of me, scurrying along like some giant praying mantis. Then the trail switched back and the wind was in my face, blowing back my hood and filling my eyes and nose with water. I turned my head and my ear filled too. I crouched and tightened my hood. Then I squinted and leaned into the wind. 4 more miles and another 1,000 feet up. This was insane. It was already getting dark. Suddenly, someone or something tackled me. That was the first explanation my brain could conjure when confronted with the question, why am I on my stomach and sliding toward that ledge? I rolled onto my back, and my pack snagged momentarily on a withered stump, slowing my slide somewhat. I grabbed another stump and stopped completely. I turned back to the trail, and again my hood flew back, and my face was splashed by spray. Crouching again, I turned just in time to see my pack cover sail off into the abyss, a flapping green sacrifice, not offered by me, something the storm had just taken. It's going to take me next, I thought. This is beyond insane. This is stupid. I have to get down, not up. I crawled back to the trail and turned back the way I thought I'd come, hunching and crouching and clutching at my hood for half a mile before realizing that I was still going up. Dejected but determined, I turned back again, for real this time. This time, when I reached the point where I'd fallen, I was braced for the crosswind. Even so, it still almost took me. Despite my steady exertion, I was no longer warming up from the inside. Even walking as fast as I could without slipping on the wet rocks, I was still shivering. The tree line brought moderate relief, but I knew I would have to repeat the steepest part of the day, only in reverse this time, hand over hand in a freezing sideways rain. I did it. When I stumbled back in through the front door of the Mitzvah Spring Hut, the guy in charge with his long beard and bald head was there to greet me. "Wow, you're lucky to be here. Lakes of the Clouds just radioed down. They've got 70-mile-per-hour winds up there. You're not heading north, are you?" He didn't recognize me. Of course he didn't. He saw dozens of hikers every day, and I hadn't looked like a drowned rat the first time we met. "I am." "Well, you're in luck," he said. "We have room for exactly one more work for stay. You should probably go put on dry clothes and eat some turkey first." He led me into the kitchen. "Here, eat this." He handed me some hot meat and a cup of tea. I took it and thanked him as I stood dripping all over the kitchen floor. In a blink, Breakfast Club was on it with a mop. The guy in charge asked me my name and I told him. He introduced me. "Guys, this is Green Giant." Tupac was washing dishes with his back to us. He didn't turn around. "Never heard of him." Ninja Mike handed me a towel. "You look like hell, brother." I was left in their custody, and after I found a place to change into my dry clothes, I put on an apron and joined the guys in the kitchen. We served dinner to the paying guests, mostly couples my age and their children. The women all wore nail polish, and the men sported perfect haircuts and a day or two of stubble. Their parkas were spotless, and the crowd smelled like soap. One man still had a price tag on his pants. After we fed them, the four of us sat at a table and ate our own huge plates of turkey, beans, mashed potatoes, and bread. We had three bowls of soup each, and I ate two salads. Dessert was apple cobbler. We spent the next hour washing dishes while watching the storm rage outside. All of the bunks were full, so the guy in charge put the four of us upstairs in a small library, a single room with shelves full of games and books. We put our sleeping bags in the corners and took turns playing chess while planning the next day. The weather forecast for tomorrow was perfect. The top of Mount Washington would be cold but clear, with visibility predicted at 120 miles. You could almost see the curvature of the earth. But we needed supplies again, beyond what the huts could offer. We had to go down. In the morning, we took an easy supply trail from the hut down to Pinkham Notch. After a resupply there at the bottom, we switched trails and started back up toward Mount Washington through Tuckerman Ravine. The first 2 miles took us up a relatively gentle slope with a near vertical rock wall looming in the distance. Halfway up, the pines abruptly stopped in a neat horizontal row, and the trail drew us into a steep fold carved out by a waterfall. Since we could see the falls from here, I thought, it had to be hundreds of feet high. Ninja Mike pointed at the falls. "Let's go! Straight up!" He ran. Tupac followed. Breakfast Club shrugged. "I'm not running, but holy shit, I can't wait to be up there." He took off at a brisk pace, and I followed. We spent the next hour scrambling up rocks, looking back over an ever-increasing spread of pines and smaller mountains. The roar of the falls increased as the trail zigzagged closer to it. At one tight bend in the notch, the trail disappeared behind the falls, allowing us to view the valley through a veil of mist and rainbows. Ninja Mike proposed that we skip the rest of the AT and just set up camp here. "Right here, man. Let's just live in the whites, until it gets too cold. There's no fucking way it gets better than this." He cupped his hands and leaned back. "Woo-wee!" He waited for his echo, but it never came. The chasm was too vast. He cheered anyway and bounded up the rocks, faster than any of us. The summit comes abruptly. You cannot see it or hear it until you're standing in the parking lot. There is a visitor center at the top of the world, and finding it there was so alarming that we couldn't help but pine for the relative peace of the rocks and the wind again. We stayed long enough to eat a slice of pizza and to appreciate the view. I did my best to estimate north and looked toward the horizon. So that's what 120 miles looks like, I thought. I walk from here to the horizon two more times, and we're almost there. Ninja Mike was ready. All right, boys, it's time to take off. Chapter 24, Orbit. The AT north of Mount Washington makes a great clockwise circle, and for many miles we hiked due south while somehow still making progress towards Katahdin. A day and a half later, we actually found ourselves back in Pinkham Notch again, at the same visitor center where we had resupplied days before, looking up at Mount Washington from the bottom of Tuckerman's Ravine. "We were just here," Breakfast Club lamented. "Why does the AT hate us?" The northern part of New Hampshire is made of mountains and places with fantastic names like Thunderstorm Junction, Parapet Trail, and Crater Mountain. A 20-mile section goes through the Wildcats, a range that consists of only ridiculous climbs and descents. From the tops, we could see forever, but everything in between was a mystery. We could barely find our way from blaze to blaze. The Wildcats began with a 1,000-foot climb so steep it looked like a printer's error in the guidebook. The exit was a bit more forgiving, but our knees and shoulders ached as we approached the White Mountains Lodge and Hostel near Gorham, the last little town before crossing our final state line. I shivered, partly from emotion, but also because flurries that morning had left any place still in the shadows dusted white. We arrived at the hostel just in time to meet a group of hikers headed back to the trail. Much to my surprise, among them was my old friend Bones. Most of the biting insects were long gone, so he no longer wore his head net. My first thought was that he must have been sick or hurt again for me to have caught up with him, but he was just another ultralight speed hiker humbled by the whites, exactly like the rest of us. When our groups met, we all stepped further away from the road and exchanged updates. This was the hiker grapevine in action. People were buzzing about crossing into Maine and locating friends. There was one bit of news in particular that everyone was talking about. Bones was the first to share it with me. "Green Giant, this should interest you. It's about a friend of yours." "Who's that?" I said. "Your old pal Voldemort almost ended her hike in Hanover." "Whoa, really? What happened? Is she okay?" "She's fine, but she lost all of her gear." "What? How?" To say she lost her gear was inaccurate. Her pack had been stolen. Megan had almost caught up with us. She was at the grocery store in Hanover, resupplying to start the whites when it happened. She left her pack outside the store, as hikers do in every trail town, and when she returned, it was gone. For Megan, this was the equivalent of losing her home. Tent, sleeping bags, clothes, all of it gone. Even her poles. Word spread fast. Miss Janet and the bubble weren't too far ahead, and soon people were sending donations. Extra gear, things abandoned in the van, cash, even a pack that belonged to someone who had been forced to quit because of a broken ankle. Hanover is a hiker-friendly town, and more than one resident offered up a spare room in their homes while she re-equipped, but the ordeal set Voldemort back almost 5 full days. She should have been barreling down the Wildcats, hot on our tails. Instead, she was probably just now starting the whites. I wondered whether all the never-saying-goodbye business really only applied at the start. We had assumed any deficit could be overcome back when the trail seemed infinite. But now we were running out of trail. I could count the number of remaining resupplies on one hand. The following day, as we headed back to the trail, our group met another, arriving at the hostel, and much to my surprise, among them was my friend Lemmy. He had picked up his cold weather gear and was wearing all of it. Thick pants, gloves, a parka over a sweater, and a scarf that covered everything but his eyes. He leaned on his memory stick with each step, and his hat made him look like a puffy, lumbering bear, ready to hibernate. "You should be careful dressed like that around here, Lemmy. Someone's going to shoot you and make a rug out of you." He tugged the scarf enough to uncover his mouth. If it gets me next to a fireplace, I will pull the trigger for him. The first climb out of Gorham ended at the top of a rocky bald named Mount Hayes. The wide, exposed top was a maze, walled in by